I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Well, it's official. Neil Gorsuch is President Trump's nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court, filling the seat left vacant after the death of Antonin Scalia last February. Gorsuch has been a federal appeals court judge in Denver and is said to have a legal philosophy that's similar to Scalia's, conservative and originalist. Senate Democrats still angry about the treatment of former President Obama's Supreme Court pick Merrick Garland have promised a fight, maybe even a filibuster. Judge Gorsuch spoke last night in the East Room of the White House.
As this process now moves to the Senate, I look forward to speaking with members from both sides of the aisle, to answering their questions and to hearing their concerns. I consider the United States Senate the greatest deliberative body in the world, and I respect the important role the Constitution affords it in the confirmation of our judges. I respect, too, the fact that in our legal order, it is for Congress and not the courts to write new laws. It is the role of judges to apply, not alter, the work of the people's representatives. A judge who likes every outcome he reaches is very likely a bad judge. Stretching for results he prefers rather than those the law demands.
Well, we'll be talking about Judge Gorsuch and the Senate's role of advice and consent, and later discuss the legality and constitutionality of President Trump's travel ban. Let me introduce our two guests, and joining us here in our Philadelphia studio, Jeffrey Rosen, President and CEO of the National Constitution Center. And Jeffrey, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It is wonderful to be here.
So much to talk about.
Yes.
And Meg Kinnard joining us by telephone. Meg is politics and legal affairs reporter at the Associated Press. And Meg Kinnard, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me give out that phone number, and it's 1-888-477-9499. I'm sure many people have many questions about Judge Gorsuch, but also this process that will begin. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jeffrey, let me begin with you. Would a President Jeb Bush or a President Mitt Romney have picked Judge Gorsuch for the U.S. Supreme Court, do you think?
Yes, if they were smart.
If they were smart.
Yes.
Meaning it's a smart choice?
It's a really smart choice. And he's just one of the most respected conservative intellectuals in the country. He would be at the top of any Republican shortlist. In addition to his incredibly gifted writing style and his ability to transform the law as a strict constructionist, he, as icing on the cake, knows Justice Kennedy really well, for whom he clerked, and is able to appeal to him and maybe even bring him over to the conservative side more than other people on the short list might have. So for all these reasons, if President Trump is remembered for nothing else, this will be seen as a really good strategic decision.
Meg, how is this seen in Washington, D.C., this pick?
In Washington, as you both are well aware, there's quite a dramatic environment going into this nomination. It's been long known that President Trump would have the opportunity to put at least one and probably several folks on the court if he stays in office. And Democrats are still smarting. They still remember the very recent struggle over Merrick Garland and the inability to even get him a hearing, much less a confirmation. So they are coming out today and before even last night's announcement, some of them saying very strongly that they would be opposing this nomination. Republicans, for a lot of the reasons that Jeffrey just mentioned, have said that they are happy with this, that they're maybe seeing this, I don't know that anyone said it explicitly, but they're seeing this nomination as perhaps a confirmation of the conservatism that President Trump will be exhibiting in some areas. I think there are some Senate Republicans and perhaps others on Capitol Hill that still weren't exactly sure ideologically in some ways where the president lies. But the selection of Judge Gorsuch for the Supreme Court is an indicator in that direction.
When we talk about, Jeffrey, him being a conservative, but also being an originalist and being close to Scalia's philosophy, are there ways that you think Judge Gorsuch parted ways with Scalia? Are they kind of built or created out of the same legal and constitutional cloth?
There are important ways where he parts ways with Justice Scalia. Justice Scalia was a Hamiltonian. He believed that the federal government should have broad discretion to enforce regulations. Gorsuch is more of a Jeffersonian. He has questioned the constitutional underpinnings of the regulatory state. He said that there's a behemoth in the room, and that's a Supreme Court decision called Chevron, which sounds wonky but is important because it requires judges to defer to executive agencies when they interpret laws. We're seeing how important that is with this controversy about President Trump's immigration orders and the question of whether he's faithfully interpreting immigration laws or freelancing. So Judge Gorsuch's willingness to rethink the deference that judges like Scalia traditionally gave to regulations and to enforce liberty in the face of executive orders to threaten it may actually be important down the road.
Mm, interesting. Let me go back to you, Megan. And you mentioned Justice Kennedy, Judge Gorsuch clerked for Kennedy. One of the things I was reading this morning was that by picking him, this gets a little bit into the weeds, it sends a message to Kennedy, who's 80 years old, that it might be time for him to retire. Meg, can you add to that? And Jeffrey, I want to get your response to that. Do you think that's part of the message coming from the Trump administration?
That could very well be possible. And as Jeffrey mentioned, you know, Justice Kennedy and Judge Gorsuch have a long relationship, and that's something that we've never seen before, at least for a justice and a former clerk to both be on the court at the same time. One would imagine that if not in agreement at all times, they would at least have the ability to work together and see some of these cases perhaps through similar lenses. In terms of an ideological replacement, perhaps, I'm not sure. I think, you know, some of this remains to be seen in terms of what kind of a justice Judge Gorsuch would be. You know, it's funny. One of the first things when someone is nominated in these sorts of situations is, you know, we always want to know, well, how do they stand on this issue? How would they rule on this issue? And in the confirmation process, nominees are, of course, very careful not to say definitively. And one thing that's been discussed about Judge Gorsuch is his ability to look at cases singularly, individually, not at a perhaps an issue-wide lens. And I think that that's certainly something that senators will want to hear more about when we go through the confirmation process.
I mean, Jeffrey, this is a more political question, but do you think nominations should work that way, sending a message to members of the court, and there are a number of them who are getting on in years, that it's safe to retire?
Well, they are political, whether they should be or not, and you definitely want a nomination that's going to advance your strategic goals. And Meg is absolutely right, and I think the thought with Kennedy is he's concerned about his legacy. He doesn't want it to be overturned. And he doesn't know whether or not to trust President Trump to appoint justices who would preserve his legacy or threaten it. So the thinking is that since he likes and trusts Gorsuch so much, he might be reassured that if he resigns, President Trump will appoint more judges like Gorsuch than a judge who would dismantle his legacy. And in light of indications that he was thinking of resigning before the election, might be more inclined to resign. The counterargument is there's no guarantee that the next judge is going to look like Gorsuch, and Kennedy can figure that out too. And for all those reasons, you know, he's extremely smart. He might not be moved by that particular consideration.
Do you think the Republicans were wrong not to at least hold a hearing on Merrick Garland? And we should add that Scalia died almost a year ago. It was in February of 2016.
Well, as the head of the nonpartisan National Constitution Center, I can say descriptively that it was a longer period of time than any nominee had ever faced before. My hero, Justice Louis Brandeis, waited 160 some odd days between nomination and confirmation. Merrick Garland had to wait much longer and never got a hearing. So there's no question that the norms, they are a change in. And if the Democrats get back the Senate and there were a nomination even, you know, in this third year of a presidency of a Republican president, I wouldn't be surprised if they decided payback was in order and refused to confirm anyone then.
Meg, do you think Democrats want revenge?
I think revenge is a very strong word. There perhaps are some on Capitol Hill who would see it that way. You know, Jeffrey's right. The period where Merrick Garland's nomination languished in the Senate was very painful and was something that Senate Democrats were very, very vocal on. I think history could be a good indicator and could teach us some lessons here. You know, looking back to the Bush presidency, there was a lot of consternation about not necessarily Supreme Court nominations off the bat, but other federal judicial nominations early in his presidency. And Democrats controlled the Senate at that time, and there were some nominees who were held up without hearings or committee votes. But in 2002, at the midterms, things changed, as they often do early in a presidency. And there was Republican control of the Senate. Democrats were then on the defensive, so to speak, looking towards filibusters and other options to try to keep some of those nominees from moving through. So D.C. is a cyclical place, as we well know, congressionally every 2 years. A lot of Senators are up in 2018, and there are many who have already started talking about how, you know, their reelection could perhaps be in the balance a bit, given their stance for or against, soon to be, or perhaps someday, Justice Gorsuch. So there is always politics at play, even though the judges and justices themselves, at least when they're sitting there in front of the Senate, try to personally stay out of it.
Well, let me ask it to you slightly differently, Jeffrey Rosen. Let me quote from Chuck Schumer, who said, "The Senate must insist upon 60 votes for any Supreme Court nominee, a bar that was met by each of President Obama's nominees. The burden is on Judge Neil Gorsuch to prove himself to be within the legal mainstream and in this new era, willing to vigorously defend the Constitution from abuses of the executive branch." Raising several questions. One was whether you think it hurt the court to go for almost a year with just 8 members, and whether the sort of bar that Schumer talks about is a good bar to have.
Did it hurt the court? Justice Ginsburg said yes. Justice Alito said no. And is it a good bar? I think the question is it an effective bar? And if the Democrats decide to filibuster this nomination, then the Republicans will blow up the filibuster. So they face a strategic choice.
A nuclear option.
Should they wait and hold their fire and wait until if Justice Kennedy were to resign, that's the really consequential seat. And if they didn't exercise the filibuster this time, then the next time they could say, hey, this precedent remains in place. We've respected it. Let's hope that it holds. The counter to that is the Republicans might just blow up the filibuster the second time. So there may not be a lot of good options.
Do you think, and we're almost having a break here, but from the nomination process or the confirmation process where a nominee is asked hopefully hard questions, is that where the battle should take place in a sense?
Well, hard questions are great. And this is just the last opportunity the country has to really explore Judge Gorsuch's judicial constitutional philosophy. It's absolutely a legitimate question. Would he enforce constitutional limits on the executive branch as well as on Congress? As it happens, he's written a lot about that, and I think he'll say that he would and believes that he would. But the idea of a substantive exploration of his constitutional philosophy is all to the good.
All to the good, and sometimes hard to do because of the kind of, I think it has been described as a kind of a kabuki dance that goes back and forth between the nominee and members of the Judiciary Committee. Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about Neil Gorsuch, and he is President Trump's pick for the U.S. Supreme Court, talking with Jeffrey Rosen, President and CEO of the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia. In fact, right across the street from WHYY, Meg Kinnard joining us by telephone, politics and legal affairs reporter at the Associated Press. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Meg Kinnard, the, I should say, politics and legal affairs reporter at the Associated Press, and Jeffrey Rosen, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, talking about what a lot of people are talking about, the fact that President Trump selected Neil Gorsuch to be his pick to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court, filling the seat left vacant after the death of Antonin Scalia. 1-888-477-9499, the number to call to join our conversation. Meg, let me go back to you, and just if you can get us, I guess, as up to speed as you possibly can about what you think the Democrats will do. Jeffrey was talking a little bit about the filibuster, but what do you think they're planning on doing in dealing with this nominee?
Obviously, it's hard to know exactly. We talked a little bit about Chuck Schumer, and he hasn't officially said whether he plans to back a filibuster or not. Several Democrats have already been very vocal. Elizabeth Warren, she's opposed to Gorsuch's previous opinions. She says that side with large companies over their workers. Sherrod Brown of Ohio, who has talked about Judge Gorsuch's rulings and also not favoring American workers, Again, both of those senators are up for re-election in 2018. Elizabeth Warren particularly is very outspoken in a variety of ways. She might not fall into the category of those extremely concerned over her re-election re-election situation as it relates to a confirmation battle for Judge Gorsuch. You know, the Senate is very divided at this moment. It seems to always be, but the divide is very close, and Republicans know that if they are going to have anything but a battle on their hands, they would need some help, and they would need some Democrats to at least not look upon this as a place to draw a line in the sand. There are plenty of Democrats, as we mentioned, who are very much smarting over Merrick Garland, and I think that it is going to take some convincing on both the part of Judge Gorsuch and on the part of some key Senate Republicans to make that argument to Democrats. Last night, one of those Republicans, Lindsey Graham, was at the White House. He sits on the Senate Judiciary Committee. That'll be the first test for Judge Gorsuch. And I think that in having people like him, obviously, Lindsey Graham also ran for the presidency and ran against Donald Trump for the nomination. But in having members of the Senate like Lindsey Graham present for announcements like this could be a way of, you know, the administration kind of showing an alliance with someone like Graham. And that could perhaps convey a little bit easier path toward confirmation.
Jiffy, let me turn back to you. Judge Gorsuch has been described as a defender of religious liberty, and there have been a number of cases where he has written and I guess, made rulings as well. How should we see his view of religion such as you understand it?
He is a strong defender of religious liberty. He wrote the lower court opinions that the Supreme Court eventually affirmed, holding that religiously observant corporations can have an exemption from the Affordable Care Act's contraception mandate. That was the Hobby Lobby case, and also a decision in the Little Sisters of the Poor case, holding that some a group of nuns didn't have to sign a federal form so that their employees could get contraception coverage. He's also recognized the rights of religious dissenters to have exemptions from generally applicable laws. And he's written a book about natural law theory and the idea that life is inherently valuable, although he stresses that that's a secular and not a religious argument, and it's not rooted in divine claims.
Oh, that's so interesting. And these are either books or a book about assisted suicide and euthanasia. I mean, it's just such a fascinating thing to think about and talk about and debate about. Do you think that's a particular interest of him, of his, the fact that he has written a book or books on this?
It's a deep interest of his, so much so that he gave up a lucrative partnership in Washington, D.C. to go to Oxford to write a DPhil on this extremely abstruse academic topic. He's passionate about it. It's a great book. Listeners should get it. I just got it on Kindle a few days ago and read it, and it's beautifully written. It's short. It's a powerful, confident book that takes on legal scholars like Richard Posner and Richard Epstein and says that they misread footnotes and they don't know what they're talking about.
Wow.
And it, you know, offers a very strong view that because human life is inherently valuable, restrictions on assisted suicide might be perfectly permissible. And indeed, the right to life might even deserve some constitutional protection.
Wow. Which raises a question, Meg, about what cases are on their way to the Supreme Court in this year ahead. What issues or what cases do you anticipate the court having to wrestle with?
There are some cases that are already set, but it's very unlikely that Gorsuch would be able to play a role in them, given the oftentimes lengthy confirmation process that could lay ahead. But the court is set to mull some cases that deal with the use of deadly force. That's a case involving a cross-border shooting of an unarmed Mexican citizen. Obviously, border issues are going to be something I know you'll be discussing a little bit later, but also are going to play largely in the Trump administration, at least with the executive order and some other anticipated actions. There's also a case that deals with the quashing of an EEOC subpoena that could be of interest, as well as a First Amendment case that deals with sex offenders and their rights or ability to use social media sites. You know, there's nothing on the horizon quite yet that perhaps would harken back to 2014 and some of the very large, you know, attention-grabbing cases that lay before the court at that time. But, you know, if you look back toward the previous term, when there were only eight justices for a while sitting on the court, there were some cases that came up, and, we sit and wonder, what could they have been like had there been a ninth justice? Had it been Merrick Garland, or had it been someone like Judge Gorsuch? And, you know, some of those cases dealt with immigration, with DAPA, which has obviously been a topic of much interest. That was a 4-4 split. There was another case that dealt with public unions. It was also a 4-4 split. So, you know, regardless of exactly what the issues are, I think that there are some watchers of the court who will at least perhaps feel that this is the way it should be, to have the inability really to reach that tie, to have another voice and actually get to a majority decision.
Anything you want to add to that, Jeffrey?
No, that's really well described.
Okay, fair enough. Let me get Lisa from Phoenixville to join our conversation. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking this call.
Sure.
My comment is just that every time it seems that the Republicans fear they're going to lose, they change the rules. They refuse to even give a hearing to someone that Orrin Hatch said was, you know, eminently qualified and would absolutely be approved if nominated. And we've seen that with gerrymandering. We see it with voter suppression. But, you know, it's just this constant changing. And I don't see the leadership in the Democratic Party calling this out and calling it what it is, which is cheating. It's just outright stacking the deck to get what they want.
Well, Lisa, let me toss it to Megan. Then we're going to have to say goodbye to Megan, get our other guest in. Do you think that's a fair critique of the Democrats, Meg?
I think that that could be said of both sides. There are already some Senate Democrats who are coming out and calling this a stolen seat. That was something that Jeff Merkley of Oregon said the other day, referring back, of course, to Merrick Garland and his inability to even get a hearing before the Senate. So I think that, you know, regardless of exactly who's in power, partisanship switches and swings dramatically in the election cycle. And this is a very partisan environment, and the nomination of a Supreme Court justice is a huge deal. It's very huge early in a presidency, and so I think that there is going to be a lot of animosity that will come forward in the coming weeks. But I think that would happen perhaps, you know, if the situations were reversed as well.
Well, Meg, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Cool. Thank you, Marty. Appreciate
You're welcome.
It.
No problem. Meg Kinnard, politics and legal affairs reporter at the Associated Press. Jeffrey, let me put an email question to you. This is from Margaret. What does it mean to be an originalist or a constitutionalist? Or I've also seen the word textualist. Mm-hmm. What are we talking about here? And then we'll get our other guest in.
Such a good question. And I won't do the full, you know, legal
you
seminar
do
on
the
it.
Constitution Center,
know.
Yes.
I think Justice Scalia said he was both an originalist and a textualist. And an originalist believes that the Constitution should be interpreted in light of the original public meaning of its text. So what did the text of the Constitution mean at the time that it was ratified? And that means you look not only at the views of Madison and Hamilton and all the guys who drafted the Constitution and proposed it in Independence Hall, but also at the people who ratified it in state conventions, which means you look at the Federalist Papers and other public documents to figure out what the document meant at the time of ratification. That's the gist of it. And those originalists are sometimes called constitutionalists. That tends to mean a willingness to enforce constitutional limitations on the power of Congress and the president, and also to respect the constitutional boundaries of the judiciary and to enforce the law, not make it. Now, opponents of this philosophy would say that it's a smokescreen, and that in practice, the originalist judges don't always separate their policy from their constitutional conclusions, and that the Constitution should be interpreted as a living document, not merely in terms of what the framers anticipated, but in terms of how its values apply today. So very broadly, that's the debate.
And that's the ongoing debate, right, about our Constitution.
It's the ongoing debate, and it's so important that citizens participate in
there
it and go to the Constitution Center website and hear both sides.
That's Jeffrey Rosen. He is the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia. Well, I'm sure that Judge Gorsuch will be asked about the travel ban that's being challenged by four states' attorneys general. The New York Attorney General called it unconstitutional, unlawful, and fundamentally un-American. Here in Pennsylvania, lawyers for Syrian immigrants who were turned away at Philadelphia Airport this past weekend are suing President Trump and others, saying the ban violates the First Amendment's Establishment Clause. And adding to the legal drama, Acting Attorney General Sally Yates was fired earlier this week after saying the Department of Justice would not defend Trump's executive order on the travel ban. Joining us now is Anil Kalhan, Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University and a visiting scholar at the UC Berkeley School of Law. And Anil, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. And thanks for joining us. Let me just do a couple of little questions about this upcoming confirmation process. What kind of questions you think, Anil, that Judge Gorsuch should be asked, especially as it relates to this temporary travel ban, temporarily at least, except for the Syrian refugees? But what do you think he should be asked about this?
Well, I think that he's likely to get questions. I mean, I imagine that he probably will avoid answering them in, you know, based on the fact that these are issues that might come before the Supreme Court should he be confirmed. But I would imagine that some of them would concern the scope of the president's power, his views about presidential power more generally in implementing the immigration laws. Questions about, Jeffrey had discussed earlier, questions about religious freedom. Religious freedom questions are implicated by this set of initiatives as well. But as I said, I imagine that he would quickly try to avoid answering the specific questions. But of course, the broader questions would be relevant to a broader range of issues that might come before the court and would certainly be relevant and of interest to senators of both parties in understanding what kind of justice he would be.
Jeffrey, what kind of questions do you look for, even more broadly speaking? And then we'll talk a bit more about some of the pushback on this travel ban.
I mean, there's so many important ones.
And there
you just
are.
You just hope that the senators will really dig into Judge Gorsuch's constitutional philosophy, be sophisticated about the difference among strict constructionists and originalists, try to figure out if Judge Gorsuch is more like Justice Thomas than Justice Scalia in a willingness to enforce limits on the regulatory state, figure out where he stands on the role of precedent, try to figure out whether he's more inclined, like Chief Justice Roberts, to defer to laws passed by Congress, as Roberts insisted on doing in upholding the Affordable Care Act, or whether he's more willing to second-guess those laws, as Justice Thomas is. So just not sticking to the slogans, but really digging into the nature of his constitutional philosophy. He's written so much. There's just – and it's really well written, so it's not hard to read. Let's get wonky and find out what he thinks.
Well, John, this is not a particularly wonky thing that John Roberts said, but he talked about calling balls and strikes, I guess, famously. People have criticized him to say that being a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court is more than calling balls and strikes. But is that a helpful metric for us outsiders watching the court? Jeffrey?
Balls and strikes? Not really. No, it's a nice ideal, but it's not. It doesn't describe the way different justices, liberal and conservative, actually interpret the Constitution. I think that instead, senators should ask, "What's the difference between a?" Just like your great listener question, what's the difference between someone who's more of an originalist, more of a textualist, more of a constitutionalist, cares more about precedent, is more of a pragmatist, cares about natural law? This is a hugely significant question. Is Judge Gorsuch's interest in natural law, might that lead him to side with Justice Kennedy in recognizing a broad right to dignity that could favor marriage equality because of the inherent dignity of all human beings, as Judge Gorsuch talked about? Or could it lead him to recognize the dignity of the fetus and its right to life? That in exploring whether or not he's likely to overturn Roe v. Wade, which is a legitimate question, you want to just dig into what natural law means to him and how he thinks it applies.
Let me put something else on the table, and Anil, I'll go back to you. This was about a year ago. Interestingly, Senator Sessions was asking Sally Yates, do you think the attorney general has the responsibility to say no to the president if he asks for something that's improper? Now, this was asked when the president was Barack Obama. Yates responded, Senator, I believe the attorney general or deputy attorney general has an obligation to follow the law and the Constitution and to give their independent legal advice to the president. And of course, she was fired earlier this week because she would not uphold the travel ban that came from the executive order over the weekend. Are we on some kind of a collision course here, do you think? Anil?
Collision course in what sense?
Well, I mean, she was fired for not carrying out a law that she believed, for whatever legal reasons that she believed was either unconstitutional or illegal.
Well, I think that the whole episode, and it is quite striking to see that exchange between Senator Sessions and Sally Yates in light of what has now happened. The entire episode in terms of her dismissal does raise some concerns and questions that about the independence of the Justice Department. And, you know, we are in a somewhat uncharted territory. That's a very unusual episode to happen. And, you know, traditionally the Justice Department has valued its independence from the White House. And as she had indicated in her answer to Senator Sessions, she had viewed the role as one as an obligation to follow the law and to make her own independent judgment. Of course, the Attorney General swears an oath adhere to the Constitution, right, not an oath of allegiance to the president. So this is a question I think a lot of people will have going forward about the independence of the Justice Department.
Well, let's take a very short break. I do want to pick up on that and toss it to our other guest, Jeffrey Rosen. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, talking about a whole host of things, including the fact that President Trump has picked his pick for the U.S. Supreme Court, a judge named Neil Gorsuch. We've been talking about what we know about him, talking a bit more about some of the legal and constitutional questions raised by the travel ban, talking with Jeffrey Rosen from the National Constitution Center and Anil Kalhan from Drexel University. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Anil Kalhan. He's Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University, also a visiting scholar at the Berkeley School of Law in California. UC Berkeley School of Law in California. Also with us, Jeffrey Rosen, President and CEO of the National Constitution Center. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jeffrey, I'd just be curious about how we should see an attorney general, in that the acting attorney general was relieved of her duties when she would not uphold the travel ban. How should we see that person's job? And as Anil said, they do make an oath to the U.S. Constitution.
They do. And Senator Jeff Sessions, in his hearings for attorney general, said that the attorney general should exercise independent constitutional judgment and should tell the president when he believes that he's acting unconstitutionally. And the Office of Legal Counsel of the Justice Department issues constitutional advice to the president. On the other hand, the attorney general works for the president. The president has the constitutional authority to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. The attorney general helps him do that as his delegate. So therefore, if the president believes that the attorney general is refusing to carry out his interpretation of the laws, he's certainly within his constitutional authority to fire the attorney general.
We learned that on the Saturday Night Massacre of many years ago.
We sure did. President Nixon wanted to fire the special prosecutor. The attorney general wouldn't do it. He resigned. Then the deputy attorney general resigned. And finally, the solicitor general, Robert Bork, had to issue the firing. And there's no doubt that the associate attorney general, the acting attorney general, was within her rights in refusing to carry out the law. And in fact, Senator Sessions asked her in her confirmation hearings if she would do that. Mm-hmm. But the president was also within his rights to fire her.
Anil, let me go back to you. And I did quote the New York attorney general calling this this travel ban unconstitutional, unlawful, fundamentally un-American. From your perspective, is it unconstitutional, unlawful?
I think there are serious constitutional questions, serious statutory questions that arise from this in terms of the Equal Protection Clause of the component of the Fifth Amendment, due process of law, potentially the Religion Clauses of the First Amendment. this kind of program is really without precedent, and it's very sweeping. And I think courts will there's not a lot of legal precedent to draw upon. So, you know, courts, and given the significant public attention and concern and the demonstrations and really the chaotic rollout over the weekend, I think courts are going to be taking a very close look.
Well, and clearly they are. But what's the difference, Anil? Carter instituted a ban. This was after the Iranian hostage crisis. President Bush did after 9/11. Even President Obama did, related to some Iraqis that came into the United States that raised some questions. Why is this different, Anil?
This is quite different. So those initiatives were all very narrowly targeted, typically tied to a specific exigent circumstance, a specific factual threat. The one that is being pointed to from 2011 under the Obama administration was targeting one country based on specific information of people who had been admitted to refugees from Iraq, and it was not a shutdown. It was focused on sort of reinforcing and strengthening the vetting processes that were in place. This one is a blanket suspension of all refugee admissions, a reduction and an indefinite ban on Syrian refugees. When the refugee processing resumes, the executive order contemplates having a religious preference for people who are from minority religions, which is inconsistent with our obligations under the Refugee Convention, but also raises questions as a matter of domestic constitutional law, potentially as a matter of statutory law. And beyond that, this goes to suspend admissions of all non-immigrants and immigrants from the seven countries that are covered by the order now. And even beyond that goes further to suggest that all immigration programs going forward will need to incorporate this is sort of tucked away in the order. I don't think it's gotten much attention. A process to evaluate the applicant's likelihood of becoming a positively contributing member of society and their ability to make contributions to the national interest. Those kinds of provisions go way beyond even the stated basis for why this order is being put into effect, and probably conflict with the scheme that Congress has already set forth for who are people who are in the national interest to admit to the United States.
Jeffrey, how do you see this? And it's been less than a week. There has been some confusion. I don't think chaos is exactly the wrong word to describe it. You've got judges pushing back. You've got attorneys general pushing back. You've got lawyers pushing back. You've got the ACLU. Are we seeing the system working or in tatters?
The system is working. The system is designed for conflict. The system is designed to separate powers to protect liberty. So the fact that judges are issuing independent judgments and that state attorneys generals are kicking in and that the question of whether Congress's authority is being exceeded is exactly what James Madison had in mind. And far from being a constitutional crisis, this is a sign of a healthy constitutional debate.
Do you think, maybe this is asking an opinion, which is not fair, but do you think there is some sort of religious overtones to this decision? Because at least locally, that the suit involves the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment.
Yes. Well, the acting attorney general, in refusing to enforce the order, said that she believed that extrajudicial statements by President Trump and some of his supporters like Rudolf Giuliani suggested that although the ban is neutral on its face, it was infected by an animus against Muslim Americans or more Muslim non-citizens. And the order itself also talks about protection of people who are minority religions in Muslim countries, seeming to refer to Christians. So therefore, as Neil said, too, the basis of one of the basis for a challenge is indeed that this is a violation of the Establishment Clause.
So what is written?
Marty, may I add something?
Yeah, about Neil, go ahead.
So I think we need to make sure that all the facts come out about how this has been rolled out. But let me just point to a few things that I agree with Jeff that it's not going to rise, that maybe this doesn't rise to the level of crisis, but may sort of cause some concern about how well the system is working. The first one is that it seems pretty clear that these executive orders were formulated and drafted and issued in a manner that is somewhat irregular as to consultation between all the relevant agencies and, you know, really driven by the White House, even overruling the Department of Homeland Security in terms of, you know, who would be covered. The order sweeps broadly to cover green card holders, for example, even though the Department of Homeland Security had said that they did not, that it should not cover them, and they were overruled. There's reports that the Secretary of Homeland Security, or maybe the Secretary of Defense, had watched this order being signed on TV while being consulted about it. The other thing is that when these court decisions started to come down over the weekend, staying the order, there are widespread reports that officials within the enforcement agencies at the border disregarded these orders. And, you know, where were the instructions coming from, if any, or the guidance as to how frontline officers doing, you know, the important and difficult jobs that they have to do, are, were they being given guidance about this? Were they being guidance not to follow this? We don't know. But in context, I think there's reasons for concern when you have a duly issued court order and widespread reports that executive agency officials are disregarding those orders because, you know, of course, famously, right, like the court does not have its own enforcement apparatus. It depends upon a willingness of the executive branch to honor what the court decisions are. And then finally, in order to ensure that we know what happens, I think what's important to see robust congressional oversight. Congressional oversight is not simply a matter of opposition to the executive branch or a confrontational. It's often also just a helpful way of ensuring transparency and accountability in what the executive branch is doing. And I think it remains to be seen whether Congress is going to exercise a robust oversight role. You know, the early indications and the reactions to this order are mixed. I mean, some have raised concerns. Some have, you know, said that they fully endorse what's being done, even if they're a little bit embarrassed about how well it's been rolled out. But I think that's an important thing to watch. You know, how is Congress going to respond, at least in bringing, if nothing else, in bringing facts to light?
Well, let me pick up on that. And just sort of a sort of generic question to you, Jeffrey, about whether something is constitutional or not. Does process matter? I mean, does process matter in our understanding and even whether something is constitutional or not?
Process matters a lot about whether something is constitutional or legal. And one of the challenges here is that this was not ruled out with proper processes and therefore violates the Administrative Procedure Act. But I should say this is a really complicated case with a lot of statutory and constitutional challenges. We're going to have a phenomenal podcast at the National Constitution Center with Anil on one side and Peter Spiro on the other side. It's going to be published tomorrow. I want listeners to go to the Constitution Center website, constitutioncenter.org, or subscribe to our great We the People podcast and hear the arguments on both sides and make up your own minds. These are tough legal issues, and you have to educate yourself about them so you can be an informed and engaged citizen.
Well, what a small world, because Peter Spiro was our guest on Monday talking about this very thing. He is great. Let me get Dave from Dresher to join us. Dave, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
My
question is about the proposed religious test. Doesn't our refugee rules, even before Trump's executive order, not only include but also require a religious test? Whether or not, doesn't matter what your religion is, aren't you required to show that you're being discriminated against based on being a minority? And that's my question.
It's a good one. And Anil, can I toss that to you?
Yeah, sure. So to establish your status as a refugee, you have to show a well-founded fear of persecution or that you have faced persecution on account of race, religion, nationality, or political opinion or membership in a particular social group, and of course there are many numbers of different groups that could qualify. And so religion can be a basis for being a refugee. It's importantly not the only basis. There are plenty. I think, you know, the proposals to limit refugee admissions to minority religions seems to suggest that other people don't can't establish the fact that they are legitimately refugees. Now, for one thing, there are plenty of Muslims who would have religion-based claims. They might be from a minority sect, They might have a different view of Islam than those who are persecuting them. Right. But there are also plenty of other groups that face persecution. And there are provisions, express provisions in the Refugee Convention that prohibit implementing refugee protection in a manner that discriminates on the basis of religion. That's also reflected in U.S. domestic law.
Let me read a couple of comments. An email from Bill: if Democrats filibuster a qualified judge, they'll be weakening the status of the Senate. An email from a listener: I've never seen a party almost bleed from the eyes over the election loss. Stomp your feet, cry, obstruct. That's the Democratic Party. A comment from Monica: please discuss Citizens United. We probably won't have time to do that. A comment from Dale: is there a difference between the attorney of the president and the attorney general? You probably go to the U.S. Constitution website and there'll be an answer to that. There is, Jeffrey, a question from Rosemary: what is Neil Gorsuch's view on the death penalty? We began with him and looks like we might end with him. But what do we know about that?
Great question. The SCOTUS blog concludes that he's not been friendly to death penalty petitioners, but notes that he's following a congressional law passed in the 90s that requires limitations on appeals by death penalty people. Gorsuch has worked with other judges in Oklahoma to professionalize Oklahoma's death penalty appellate defense system, which improved things for the representations. And that's basically what we know. He's not had big death penalty cases, and his book on the preservation of life does not address the question of the death penalty.
Anil, what would you want to ask Judge Gorsuch?
I would want to ask, I think, you know, Jeffrey covered a lot of the big questions that are important for the American public to know. I would sort of, in light of this conversation, probably focus to a significant extent on his views of presidential power and executive power. You know, Jeffrey highlighted the issue of deference to administrative agencies' expertise. It's not so clear whether that translates into a view of a more limited view of the scope of presidential power. And I think that's especially given that he's being appointed by a president who seems interested in exercising broad presidential power. I think that's something I would want to know more about.
I saw something in the New York Times. This is about Judge Gorsuch. He's criticized liberals for turning to the courts rather than the legislatures to achieve their policy goals and has called for limiting the power of federal regulators. And Jeff, we're almost out of time here, but I know certainly President Trump wants to reduce the level of regulation. And it looks like he's found a kindred spirit, at least on paper, with Judge Gorsuch.
Yes, in that article, which was in the National Review, Judge Gorsuch was criticizing desegregation cases like Brown versus Board of Education and talked about decisions being resolved in the political process, not in the courts. And he has this amazing paragraph at the end where he says that litigation addiction involves permanent minority status for the Democratic Party. So it's quite.
Wow.
But turnabout's fair play, and Democrats will say, hey, we hope Judge Gorsuch doesn't himself strike down a lot of federal and state laws and impose conservative policy preferences through the courts. And that's why the question of his views on deference is so important.
Wow. Well, much more to discuss. And my thanks to both of you. Jeffrey Rosen, thanks as always for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks. It's been wonderful.
And he is the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. Anil Kahan, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University. And we also had during the hour Meg Kinnard, politics and legal affairs reporter at the Associated Press, talking about such an important decision made last night, President Trump's pick for the U.S. Supreme Court. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.